This is an encore presentation of Keeping the Faith. This program was first broadcast in June.
This is Keeping the Faith, a weekly discussion about issues of faith, spirituality, religion, and ethics. Now here's your host, Steve Shoemaker.
We're talking today on Keeping the Faith about recent research on the historical Jesus, and we're talking by phone with our guest, Professor Margaret Mitchell from the University of Chicago. Can you hear me, Professor Mitchell?
Hi, Steve.
How are you?
I'm okay. How are you?
Thank you for being on the program. Now, what the studies about the historical Jesus have been coming out, for a lot longer, but there's been a huge sort of production of articles and talk show guests and books on the historical Jesus just over the last 10 or 15 years. Why has there been so much recent interest in this topic?
Well, it's an interesting question, Steve. I think one of the things that's curious, especially about it, is that a lot of the interest has been in North America, in the United States in particular.
Not so much in Europe.
There's been some interest in Europe, in Germany, and a few scholars in Great Britain, but there is a kind of American quality to this, what some term the third and others term the fourth wave of the quest of the historical Jesus. One of the reasons I think that it's aligned so much with America is because of the media prominence of a group in California referred to as the Jesus Seminar. And the Jesus Seminar made it as part of their mandate that they wanted very much for their proceedings to be a kind of a counter-academy that published its findings in a way that was open to a wider audience. And so they would have reporters present when they unveiled their results and so on. And that struck a lot of people the world over as a kind of peculiarly American enterprise.
But that made it very well known, at least in this country.
Right, it did very much so. And I think we also have now a kind of tradition of media attention to things like the historical Jesus, especially during Holy Week. I always begin my lectures on historical Jesus research with the covers of Time, Newsweek, and U.S. News and World Report from April of whatever year I'm usually teaching in, and a couple of back issues. And they tend to have sort of, they're looking for what's now of interest in historical Jesus studies, particularly at that time. But those are more answers on the level of sort of cultural studies of,
sure,
you know, why is this of interest to people in the United States today? And I think that Jesus sells. I mean, people are curious to know this most recent find of the so-called James ossuary.
The bone box hoax, or at least it was reported as a hoax just this last week.
Right, and I'd be happy to talk about it.
Why don't we start there before we get into the historical things on the historical Jesus, because that is so current.
Sure, yeah.
What can you tell us about this?
Well, what I can tell you, let me just, in case there are people who haven't heard about this, in October, there was a news conference held by the Biblical Archaeology Society in Washington, D.C. The publisher's name is Herschel Shanks, and he had a very well-publicized press conference at which he unveiled that an ossuary had been found in Jerusalem in the backyard of an antiquities collector.
Now tell us what an ossuary is.
Oh, I'm sorry, Steve. Yeah, an ossuary is a 22-inch long limestone box which is used for the burial, secondary burial of bones that in the first century and somewhat before and after, but peculiarly in the first century in Judea, secondary burial was practiced, where corpses were first exposed in shallow tombs, and then after the flesh had decomposed, the bones were placed in a box.
I see.
This particular item, this ossuary, and we know of many, many ossuaries from the land of Israel from the first century. There's a whole catalog of them by Rachmani. But this particular ossuary was revealed, or its existence was revealed to the public because it has written on it 20 characters in either Hebrew or Aramaic. Most people think it's Aramaic. And it appears to read Yaakov, that is, if you were just reading Hebrew, you'd translate it as Jacob, the son of Joseph, and then most surprisingly, Ahui di Yeshua, which would be the brother of Jesus. And this then was this ossuary in question, which the collector, whose name is Oded Golan, said had been in his possession for several decades, was read by a French epigrapher named André Lemaire, and Lemaire pronounced it authentic, quote unquote, and wrote an article in Biblical Archaeology Review that argued that this was the earliest epigraphic reference to Jesus. The publisher, Herschel Shanks, pronounced it the most important archaeological find related to the New Testament ever, and then sort of set up a contest between the texts of the New Testament and their references to Jesus, which he said the first physical such reference is in a little scrap of papyrus from Egypt that dates to 125. And so he said, oh, this is the first, the earliest reference to Jesus that in my judgment, leaves aside the fact that we have letters of Paul that date from the 50s that mention Jesus. We don't have the physical copies of them, but we have textual traditions that go back to the 50s and hence before this ossuary. Let me add one other piece of historical data. This figure James is named in Paul's letter to the Galatians as James, the brother of the Lord, who apparently became one of the leaders of the Jerusalem church. According to the Jewish historian Flavius Josephus, he was killed by stoning somewhere around the year 61. Mm-hmm. If this ossuary is what it is claimed to be by Herschel Shanks and André Lemaire, this is a bone box in which the bones of Jesus' brother James were placed sometime after the year 61. It's not a physical object that Jesus of Nazareth either would have seen, touched, or had any relationship to, but rather this figure James had his bones put in it, and then later someone incised the ossuary with his name, and rather unusually didn't only include the patronymic of Yaakov Bar Yosef, Jacob,
son of Joseph, right.
The son of Joseph, but also, more surprisingly, and not always true to form, the brother of Jesus. So that's the claim. And then what's said is that this then is the physical object that is the closest to Jesus.
Now, there were no bones in this.
There were no bones in this. At least none. I actually read one report by a Time magazine reporter who said that it looked like there were some sort of dust and possibly little fragments on the bottom of the ossuary when he saw it, but none have been published or remarked upon.
And what came out last week that indicated, that, at least to some scholars, that this was a fake?
Okay. Well, the first thing I should say is that this artifact is, because it was found in the backyard of a collector, would not be discussed or displayed by a professional society such as the American Schools of Oriental Research, because their standards hold that archaeological findings have to be found in situ, and therefore their provenance secured.
I see.
For that reason, then, the ASOR, which is the acronym of that group, would not allow this artifact to be presented to the public and discussed in scholarly forum just because it's of uncertain provenance. At the same time, it's important to know that the Israeli Antiquities Authority has a law that anything found in the land of Israel after the year 1978 belongs immediately to the government and not to individuals. There are really good reasons for both the legal structure and for the scholarly judgments, most of all having to do with not trying to encourage looting of antiquities.
And things being sold out of the country.
And things being lost, the cultural heritage of countries being lost. And we're obviously sensitized to this after what happened in Iraq, though the dust hasn't fully cleared on exactly what did happen in the National Museum in Iraq. But people are aware of this as a problem. Well, at any rate, this ossuary had a rather unusual career from the beginning because it was found in this way. It was trumpeted by an American publisher who brought it to Toronto and received permission, rather controversially, from the Society of Biblical Literature to present it at some sessions at that meeting in November in Toronto, at which I was in attendance. And there were some debates about it at that time. People may have heard, because this was carried in the public press, that the ossuary was damaged on the way over, that it, in fact, cracked. It's unclear whether it's the pressure of the plane cabin, I guess, or of just, frankly, the jittering around while in transit. It was restored. It was glued back together in Toronto. Over 100,000 people came to see it in a 2.5-month period while it was in Toronto. Now, it returned to the land of Israel, and it was immediately confiscated by the Israeli Antiquities Authority because it's not at all clear what the provenance of the object is, and indeed if it had been purchased since 1978, then it belongs immediately to the government by law. Mm-hmm. The collector, Oded Golan, actually would have had to have been 16 years old or younger when he bought it in order to have met the requirement from 1978. He was immediately put under police investigation about the provenance of the artifact. And at the same time, the Israeli Antiquities Authority set up a commission to study the ossuary. The team was made up of 12 scholars from prominent Israeli universities and labs. They were put into two different teams. Seven of them were set to work on the epigraphy, and five to work on the physical, the chemistry, if you will, of the box.
And the epigraphy is the writing.
Right, and the epigraphy is the style of the ancient writing.
Mm-hmm.
At the meeting already in Toronto, there was a lot of controversy about whether it is, in fact, one or two inscriptions. In other words, whether someone came along later and added Brother of Jesus, either in antiquity or in modernity, in order to enhance the value of the object, or because they thought it was James, the Brother of Jesus, or for any other number of hypotheses one could generate. So, some rather reputable epigraphers lined up on both sides of the question, with a fair number thinking that the incision depth of the Brother of Jesus part was different from that of the earlier part of the inscription.
Now, since some of this does get political, of the 12, how many were Jews, how many were Christians, how many were of other religious faiths, if any?
Oh, well, this is the Israeli Antiquities Authority.
Okay.
So I don't know of any non-Jews who were on the commission,
okay.
Though there may have been some.
Right.
But this is, you know, this is a governmental-sponsored panel, and it drew on experts in Eretz Israel to do this work.
I see.
So I don't know that there were any Christians on the panel.
Uh-huh.
But the other thing that I ought to mention at this point as well is that this was not an isolated artifact that was being investigated by the commission. And there's been a little bit of confusion even in America on this, even among scholars, because people haven't realized that a second very celebrated and also politically charged artifact was brought to light in this same time period. And it's called the Yehoash inscription. It is supposed to be an inscription from the time of the first temple in Jerusalem, recording a certain set of repairs on the temple. If so...
And that first temple was destroyed.
And that first temple was, it was the temple built by Solomon, destroyed by Nebuchadnezzar in 586-587 BCE, before the Common Era.
Yes.
Now, that artifact, if authentic, would have the distinction of possibly being able to be used to justify the biblical records about the first temple and therefore about Jewish Zionist claims to the Temple Mount and so on and so on. Now, scientists can't always be in charge of what people use things for. But at any rate, this, like the James ossuary, frankly, which I didn't mention, but in the eyes of some, it calls into question the Catholic doctrine of the perpetual virginity of Mary.
If Jesus had a brother.
Because Jesus had a brother. In my judgment, that's an utterly fallacious argument, simply because the whole evidence that Jesus had a brother comes already out of the New Testament, and the fact that it's written on a box doesn't make it any different. But at any rate, both of these are highly charged artifacts with people having things at stake in them. Well, what hasn't been fully appreciated, I think, in America is that this same collector, Oded Golan, is the owner of both.
Both.
And both were being investigated by the same Israeli Antiquities Authority panel, which at a press conference last week on the 18th of June came forth with its judgment that they are both frauds. What they mean by that is that in both cases we have inscriptions which have been written as though they were ancient inscriptions. And even more than that, they have both had applied to them a false aging patina. And patina is just accumulated dust and mold and age that accrues, especially in this case, to an ossuary, in the case of the object with which we began, an ossuary that has been in a damp cave that would have accumulated over time a natural surface deposit. They came to the judgment that it's very interesting from a chemical point of view, and I'm no chemist, but that they were able to test the temperature at which the calcification took place of the patina and judged that it had been done with hot water and not with the cool natural substances inside a burial cave.
Now, I want to ask your opinion about that, but before I do, let me just take a minute to let listeners know who may have joined us later that we're talking on Keeping the Faith this afternoon with Margaret Mitchell, who's a professor at the University of Chicago. And is your official title a professor of New Testament?
Yes. I'm associate professor of New Testament and Early Christian Literature.
New Testament and Early Christian Literature. And if listeners would like to make a comment or ask a question to our guest today, anywhere you hear this program, you may call toll.
You're listening to a rebroadcast of a Keepin' the Faith program, originally aired live in June of this year. And because this is a rebroadcast, we can't accept your telephone calls today. Thanks for your understanding.
Back to Professor Mitchell. Margaret, you were saying that that both of these were listed as frauds by this team of 12 scholars
right.
from the appointed by the Israeli government. What do you think about that? I mean, you've heard some claims. Were you able to see the ossuary yourself in at the meeting in Toronto of the Society for Biblical Literature?
I actually didn't see it myself. I was told by colleagues who went that one could hardly get close to it. It was under plexiglass.
Uh-huh.
Backing, and so I did not see it myself. The scholars, there was only a small group of scholars who were invited, again by the publisher Herschel Shanks, to review the inscription up close. Otherwise, one is just a visitor to the museum, and I could see it better on their website than I could see it if I went in person.
Sure.
But I actually must say that it's sort of as a cultural critic of just biblical scholarship and its public manifestations, and I use critic there in the sense of trying to be thoughtfully evaluative, not necessarily negative.
Mm-hmm.
That it struck me as very interesting that in some ways a reliquarian paradigm took over about this object, that. It became, in fact, it was used as a judgment against some scholars who doubted its authenticity that, well, they haven't even seen it.
Mm-hmm.
But in fact, the state of modern epigraphy as well as paleography is such that one can actually, in many cases, get closer to an object through the Internet than you can in person because you can magnify
sure.
descriptions and other things. But there's this element to which this object has been packaged as a scholarly relic, such that it is the object, they say, closest to Jesus.
A holy object worthy of veneration.
Right, and therefore, so that if I haven't actually seen it, or, you know, and in fact, the website for the museum said, you know, you can come and you know, you can touch, or they didn't say you can do this, but it said that the power of this object is that it allows us to touch something so close to Jesus. And the paradox of that for me was, of course, that you couldn't touch it at all if you went. It was inside a plexiglass box.
Right.
But there was one woman interviewed. I've read a lot of the press materials on this because I find it fascinating on both the modern and ancient levels. There was one woman interviewed who brought her child along and placed her child's hands on the plexiglass.
Mm-hmm.
And she said to the reporter, I don't know if this is really the bone box of Jesus' brother, but just in case it is, I may as well sort of hedge my bets and have my child, you know, have
uh-huh.
touch it. But yet, of course, the plexiglass is meaningless. Right? I mean, but yet it's not when it becomes the encasement for an object that's been declared, oddly enough, on scholarly rather than ecclesiastical grounds, or I would say actually on faux scholarly grounds, to be authentic, then it becomes an object of veneration.
Well, let's talk just for a minute about sort of the way you think about these things when you read these reports, because I think that would
yeah.
be helpful to
sure.
listeners.
Sure.
You have, okay, let's be very basic here. Let's get a little bit of your background.
Okay.
Here you are, a professor at University of Chicago, New Testament. You study these things. Do you also, are you also a believer? I know there are some scholars who are, some scholars who aren't, in terms of the Christian faith. Do you identify yourself with the Christian faith or not?
Yes, I do.
Does that matter for scholarship?
So as a professor, as a professor of New Testament early Christian literature, my first responsibility in my classroom is to teach these texts in a way that is fair to a variety of perspectives on them. And hence, I teach within a humanistic perspective and within a history of religions perspective and, you know, world literature perspective.
And so
but
you,
also
you, so you approach them from a historical, from a literary background that scholars, regardless of their religious commitments, would all agree on.
Right.
Okay.
But I'm also quite, I mean, my own research is very, I'm very interested in the history of biblical interpretation.
Uh-huh.
So I see the devotional use and understanding of the text as fully part of the text as well. Now, in terms of my own religious background, I'm a lifelong Roman Catholic.
Uh-huh.
And I am a member of St. Thomas the Apostle Catholic Church in uh-huh. Chicago, in my neighborhood.
Uh-huh.
But I do not see my professorial work to be carried out under the domain of a Catholic approach to Scripture. Though I do that at other times. I will teach in a Catholic adult or Sunday school setting, and then
sure.
I am teaching within that purview.
But in terms of what you do as a professor of religion, you don't see the Enlightenment and what's grown out from the Enlightenment as somehow a threat to religion.
I think that realistically, the Enlightenment has caused religion to have to defend its claims in a public arena in ways that have sometimes been difficult
uh-huh.
and in other ways that have been immensely clarifying. But I myself think that religious ideas should not have, in a university setting in particular, and I think also within a pluralistic society, that religious ideas need to be part of the wider marketplace of ideas and demonstrate themselves, if you will, within the world of argumentation and evidence. Now, people's experience is a piece of evidence.
Sure.
And to the degree that people can draw on that in compelling ways to search for respect for their ideas and their role for wider society, I fully respect that. But what I mean, I guess, is I would say, for example, that I think there are, you know, if one looks at it from the point of view of argument and evidence, that within one's own religious community, what counts as argument and evidence may be different than what counts as argument and evidence in the wider world of scholarly opinion.
I see. All right. Let's go.
This case, for example, for someone to simply come forward and say, I had a dream last night that an ossuary was going to be found that belonged to Jesus, the brother of the Lord, and therefore this object is authenticated by that, does not count, as far as I'm concerned,
sure.
as a scholar, as a piece of evidence in favor of this particular artifact.
Thank you. We do have a caller on line one. Let's go to that line, and let me remind other listeners, you may call us with a comment or question, 1-800-222-9455, or in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. Line one, you're on Keeping the Faith with our guest, Professor Margaret Mitchell. Go ahead.
Can tell us a little bit more about how politics might interact with science and religion, like what might be the political value for some Jews, not all Jews, or certain Christians, not all Christians, to have found artifacts that appear to confirm Old Testament scriptures,
mm-hmm.
Either about the temple or about the fact that Jesus had a brother named James, or that there are actually artifacts that show that.
Right.
And maybe just, you know, the relationship between scientific research and on artifacts from biblical times and contemporary religious faith.
Right. It's a great question, and it certainly is posed in some really acute ways, you know, by this finding. I myself find that in the popular press, and I think that the publisher in this case of the ossuary, Herschel Shanks, has really created a climate of discussion around this that is that tends to blur those categories and tends to assume, for example, a religious significance of this object even before it's been scientifically tested,
mm-hmm.
and I find that to be troubling. I think we all know that religious authorities and political authorities have an interest in archaeological findings in the land of Israel and elsewhere. I was taught, and since you mentioned the University of Chicago, I was always taught by Justa Ahlstrom and other professors that the discipline of biblical archaeology understood as going and trying to prove the Bible true is at some level an illegitimate enterprise because you've already skewed the results before you've begun.
So that brings us... Oh, I'm sorry. Maybe you want to go on.
No, just to say that one should differentiate that enterprise from the archaeology of the land of Israel, which is a fully legitimate enterprise, but that to do it in the name of proving the Bible true is certainly going to compromise one's ability to see things that... That either don't fit inside the biblical narrative or indeed that directly challenge it.
And when you say land of Israel, do you mean the land of Israel in the biblical sense or the nation of Israel as it exists today?
Well, you know, that's always, I mean, I was using it as a deliberately vague term for the fact that those territories both do and do not intersect.
Mm-hmm.
And I myself think that nothing could be found under the sands or the rocks of current modern-day state of Israel that should automatically and without reflection provide justification for that particular set of territorial boundaries.
Mm-hmm.
But a lot of political discourse takes place on a very simplistic level. I think the same is true for this movement from, oh, we found the bone box of James, the brother of the Lord, to, oh, this disqualifies the perpetual virginity of Mary. For example, there was a quotation by the owner himself. Who would have thought that the Son of God had a brother?
Mm-hmm.
Now, I mean... That's a highly simplistic and rhetorically powerful statement, but anybody who reads the New Testament reads a list of Jesus' brothers, and they're called Adelphoi, in Mark 6:3.
So how does the Catholic Church, you said you were a Catholic, reconcile that?
Well, there's a long history of it, and I won't bore you with all the details, but there are two sort of strands of interpretation. One of the most famous strands of interpretation goes back through Jerome, and that is to judge that the word brothers there means something more like kin.
Perhaps cousin or something.
Families, right, uh-huh. And perhaps cousin.
We're going to have to go on to a couple other callers who are also waiting, but I do thank that caller for those questions. And Margaret, before we go on to the next caller, let me just remind listeners that you are listening to Keeping the Faith on AM 580 WILL. If you want to make a call, 333-9455 or 1-800-222-9455. Our guest today is Professor Margaret Mitchell from the University of Chicago on the New Testament faculty there. And we're talking about recent research on the historical Jesus and particularly the hoax of the bone box, that was, or at least the purported hoax that's been in the news for the last several months. Before we get back to our guest today, let me remind listeners that next week on Keeping the Faith, Dr. Gary Rand will be our guest, talking about music and the arts in parish life. Later on this summer, we'll be talking with Jack Good, the author of a recent book called The Dishonest Church. We'll be talking with George Johnston about reconciliation. We'll be talking with Deborah Kapp about the social dynamics of worship, and Bill Kegel about a new heaven and a new earth. Those are some of the guests coming up the next few months here on Keeping the Faith. Support for these Keeping the Faith programs is provided in part by the University YMCA at the University of Illinois in Champaign-Urbana, where I'm the executive director. The Y is the oldest religious institution at the University of Illinois. For the last 130 years, the Y has been developing student leaders by providing opportunities for social action and community service. One of the programs of the Y this summer is Communiversity. And if you'd like to take an evening course this summer on anything from exercise or ballroom dance or massage, photography, the African American experience, elementary spoken Mandarin, all sorts of things, vegetarian cooking, a seminar for singles. If you'd like to read a novel and discuss it with a group this summer, do check out the Communiversity. A lot of these classes start this week, and you can just show up to the first class. You can find the listing in your libraries with the catalog or other public places, or go to the web, universityymca.org, and then click on Communiversity. But back to our guests, Margaret Mitchell, and we have a couple callers waiting. Let's go to line number two. Go ahead, please.
Good evening.
Thank you for your patience.
Certainly. I'm not quite sure if you've touched on the subject or not. I joined a bit late, but I've recently finished a little novel called The Da Vinci Code by Dan Brown, and the author claims that parts of the novel are true, and it's an intriguing little book, and I'm not sure if you read it or not, but it claims that there are alternate gospels, gospels with radically different biologies of Jesus, and I was wondering if you could speak to that idea of alternate gospels, pardon me.
With different biographies of Jesus, huh?
Right. What might truly be out there, what is actually not that authentic, and so forth.
Great. Good question. Thanks.
I have not yet read The Da Vinci Code. And is it the one about which there is also some debate right now on copyright, or is it, do either of you know about, there's some debate.
I don't know, Margaret, and our caller has hung up just to listen.
Oh, okay. All right. Well, at any rate, no, I have not, and I will put it on my list for the summer.
All right.
What about all
what the
I can tell
of
you
all...
about alternative gospels,
right,
so-called, is that the gospel genre, Christians were literary people from the very beginning, I would argue. They, you often hear that sort of Christians wrote late, only when the eyewitnesses were dying off, and they wrote reluctantly, and I, in fact, argue the opposite, that they wrote early and robustly and enthusiastically, and one of the reasons they did...
As far as we know, Jesus.
Except for Jesus. The only thing he is said to have written was something in the sand the day the woman was caught in adultery, according to a textually uncertain text in John 8. No, that's right. Although later on, there are writings attributed to Jesus.
Hmm.
Such as an epistolary, a letter correspondence with King Abgar of Edessa and other things. But leaving that aside, Christians like to write. And once Mark inaugurated the idea of a gospel, of a good news account, a narrative of Jesus, I think Mark's is clearly the first that we have. Many others were written. You can read these. We have some. We probably don't have everything that was written of gospel literature of Jesus, but you can read these in the collection called the New Testament Apocrypha, which has other gospels. The most famous one, which has been much involved in recent historical Jesus research, is the so-called Gospel of Thomas. Thomas will surprise you if what you look for in a gospel is a narrative of the life of Jesus, because Thomas is a document that's only sayings of Jesus. There's almost no narrative in the work. But some scholars think that it is as early, or that it preserves some sayings of Jesus that are earlier than Matthew, Mark, and Luke, the so-called synoptic gospels. We also have Gnostic Gospels of Jesus, Gospels that contain revealer discourses of Jesus to his disciples that date from the 3rd and 4th centuries. And we have some really fun, but they're later, infancy Gospels of Jesus, such as the Protoevangelium of James, which tells... It's based upon the question, if Jesus were the Son of God and had miraculous powers, what about those years in between where Luke has him go up to the temple when he's 14, and what about when he becomes an adult? What was going on in all those years? Or even between his circumcision on the eighth day and when he was a youth. So they come up with some really neat stories about how Jesus used to be able to form birds out of clay or mud, and then zap them, and they would fly away.
But based on literary evidence and other evidence, those you say are pretty certain to be later.
Yes, they are. Yes.
How long from the time of Jesus?
From the time of Jesus himself?
Yeah.
Certainly more than 150 years,
okay.
Probably. I mean, Mark is probably the earliest gospel, and Mark at the earliest was composed 35 years or so after the death of Jesus.
And what's your view of the dating of Thomas?
I think Thomas is post-synoptic. That is, I think Thomas does know, probably in some collection, Mark, Matthew, and Luke in some form. And so I would date the Gospel of Thomas sometime in the mid-second century.
And would you say that there's any reason to believe that the sayings recorded in Thomas have any basis in history?
Well, this is a very difficult literary critical process, and I would not go so far as John Meyer, for example, in his book on the historical Jesus, a Marginal Jew, pretty much lumps everything in the Apocrypha together and says, Apocrypha, by the way, just is sort of the hidden books, and it means, but in common parlance, what it means is books that didn't eventually become named as canon of Scripture.
Mm-hmm.
But for Christians, that didn't become formalized until the past the middle of the 4th century in 367 anyway. But the Gospel of Thomas, I think, can't wholesale be dismissed just because its final form is probably 2nd century or even later. It may contain oral traditions, or it may contain versions of sayings that may be much earlier than the final form of the Gospel of Thomas.
Thank you. We do have a couple other callers. Let's go to line 3.
Could I just qualify one more thing on that, Steve?
Of course. Go right ahead.
But I wouldn't go as far as the Jesus Seminar and others like John Dominic Crossan, who make the Gospel of Thomas really the centerpiece for their historical Jesus.
Okay. Thank you. And line 3, you're on the air.
Hi, I would like to ask the question of Dr. Mitchell. I'm not very well versed with the New Testament or any other reference material of that era, and I wondered what you think of the chances that Jesus was actually born as a virgin or possibly an illegitimate child or the biological child of David. Is there enough reference material to really lead you towards one of those paths? And I'll hang up. I'm on the cell phone and listen on the radio.
Thank you for waiting. Could you hear that all right, Margaret?
Yes, I did. I want to answer you first as an historian, and I would tell you that as an historian seeking information to, say, write a biography of any historical figure, the first question that you wouldn't normally ask is, how did this child come to exist? Most people presume that children come to exist in the normal fashion when you're dealing with an historical figure. There are, of course, questions always about ancestry, and in the case of Jesus, there is an interesting phenomenon that the very earliest text we have that talks about his family line is the Gospel of Mark, again, chapter 6, which curiously, in 6:3, refers to him as the son of Mary. And this is in a cultural world in which usually sons would be named by their father. So our earliest attestation of him is that he was a son of Mary. And I take that as an historian. It seems pretty clear to me that his mother's name was Mary and that he was known to be his mother's son. Indeed, even Paul, who otherwise shows very little interest in such things, says he was born of a woman in Galatians 4:4. So what do we know of that? Then in the case of his father, in Matthew and in Luke, we have two different genealogies, but both of them they share a lot of the same material, but both of them say that his father's name was Joseph. And that is an historical datum that gets a bit in the way of their theological interpretation of the birth of Jesus as having been by the Holy Spirit. One of the criteria of historical Jesus research is the so-called criterion of embarrassment. That is, that the early church would be less likely to make things up that seem to throw a fly in the ointment of positions that they had reached on other grounds or already. So probably the father of Jesus, the tradition that his father was someone named Joseph, goes back also quite a ways in Christian tradition, because it seems to stand in some historical tension with the later judgment that that this birth was in some ways a miraculous birth attributed to the Holy Spirit. Now, you said at the beginning of your very good and hard question that you may not know a lot of ancient literature, but even if one dips a toe in the water of ancient literature, one finds that biographical literature about famous people contains stories of miraculous births. You don't have to go much further than the birth of Samuel in the Old Testament to see that. But also in the Roman world, the births of those who will be emperors are attended by magnificent portents in the sky and so on. The idea of Jesus' birth being told as having been the out of a special union of the divine and the human is not a unique claim on the landscape of ancient literature. But the Christians, by making that claim, are making a theological claim to the specialness of this Jesus. At a certain point, as I talk about this, I can go no further as an historian, and then one switches to the eyes of faith as to the doctrine, in my judgment, of the virginity of Mary, if you will, or the virgin birth, is primarily a doctrine about who Jesus is, and as a statement that Jesus is in some fundamental way comes from the source of God, then that is a statement to which one would make theological assent, I think, again, on different grounds of evidence and argument. But the ancient sources within the early Christian writings hold that he had a mother named Mary and a father named Joseph, and that God was conspicuously involved in the birth.
Thank you very much. We're talking on Keeping the Faith with Margaret Mitchell, a professor of New Testament and Early Christian Literature at the University of Chicago. And we have just a few minutes left. We might sneak in, we have one caller waiting. We might sneak in one other. Let's go to line one. You're on the air. Go ahead. Hello. We may have lost that caller.
Hello, it's Jim.
Oh, yeah, go right ahead.
Oh, this is Urbana, not Champaign.
Yes.
I'm sorry. Margaret, I hesitate to throw this at you, and I waited toward the end of the show to do this, but I wanted to get your take. You're up there next door to the Oriental Institute.
Yes.
And in the current Nature magazine, we have Tim White's piece on the new finds in Ethiopia. We have 160,000-year-old Homo sapiens. And I wanted to ask you to what extent you thought that would throw a sabot, that is the Dutch wooden shoe, into the works of the scientific creationists. I'm sorry for doing that. It's been a fascinating show. I'll let you go and see what you say.
Yes, could you hear that?
Yes, I did, Jim, and I don't myself have independent info, even though I'm sitting 7 blocks away from the Oriental Institute, about the Ethiopian excavations. But I guess I would say I'm not really sure that finding in itself is any different than any than many, many other indications that the creationist dating of the origin of life, and especially the origin of the human species, is untenable on the basis of the physical data of when Homo sapiens first emerged. But I think I should go pick up, along with Da Vinci's Code, pick up the most current issue of Nature and follow the thread with you.
But you have no problem in general accepting the early dates for the evolution of human beings and tying that in with your understanding of the Hebrew Bible and the Christian Bible?
No, I think that, I mean, I am a literary historian. As a literary historian, I understand that the Book of Genesis teaches many things, but it is not a modern scientific history. And to apply to it claims of inerrancy and expectations and canons of modern science is, in my judgment, a literary misreading of form, which is myth.
And so you think people who try to add up the ages given in the Bible of the various people from Adam on is simply misguided?
Well, you know, as I told you at the beginning, Steve, I one of my major research interests is the history of biblical interpretation. And one, I think, cannot be a sensitive reader of the history of biblical interpretation if one goes into it trying to put some in the sheep category and some in the goats. That the fact is that biblical texts are open to a wide range of interpretations. I seek to try to understand and respect the ways in which different sets of assumptions will naturally bring one to different kinds of reading.
We have two other callers. Let's go to line two and see if we can get in both. You're on the air with Margaret Mitchell. Go ahead, please.
Hello. I was just interested in your discussion. And in our Catholic catechism, we refer to St. Joseph as Jesus' foster father. And as you said before, his brothers are referred to in the Catholic Church as cousins or kin. Also, in when we pray the Hail Mary, we also at one point we say Holy Mary, Mother of God, mm-hmm. which is another way we refer to Jesus, I assume. And another thing that struck me is the Catholic Church claims that at Mary's death, she was assumed into heaven. And we have the celebration of the Assumption of the Blessed Virgin Mary. I just wanted to mention those as a comment. Thank you.
Any response?
No, I think that the caller has represented aspects of Catholic piety and teaching, and I guess I would just say that the Catholic Church is based upon an understanding of religious authority that is not sola scriptura, not only scripture, as in the Protestant world, and hence the traditions, and therefore the judgments about them go deeper than just does the Bible say X, Y, or Z.
Thank you very much.
Thank you for bringing those to our attention.
And we have, I guess, our final caller probably on line four. Would you mind telling us where you're calling from, please?
Sullivan, how many Immaculate Conceptions are there in the Bible?
How many Immaculate Conceptions?
Yes. You know, two, three, four. Just shot in the dark. It doesn't matter really to me. The thing is, if they were then, why don't we have them now? it's interesting because I have a medical student. If you have a DVA, which is developmental anatomy and whatever, you can only go from the blastula to the gastula, you know, 2 and 4 cell divisions before the embryo terminates. Do you know what I mean?
If I could just make one clarification here,
yeah.
The Catholic doctrine of the Immaculate Conception is actually not about Jesus. That's a doctrine about Mary
and it says that Mary was conceived without original sin preparation for her role as Theotokos, as Mother of God.
So the Immaculate Conception does not refer to being born without a human father.
Right. I think what the questioner is speaking about is the virgin birth.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, how many virgin births are there in the Bible? A lot depends upon how one reads Isaiah 7, whether the Hebrew word there is supposed to be read alma, is virgin or young woman. I think in Hebrew it's quite clear that it's just a young woman, and she becomes the mother of King Hezekiah. But the Christians interpreted that prophecy as through their Greek scriptures, with the Greek word parthenos, where we have the Parthenon of Athena in Athens, and that term becomes important for Christian understanding of the birth of Jesus as having been through a virgin. And that is the main plot line, virgin birth, in the Christian Bible, at any rate.
We're down to our last minute, literally, with Margaret Mitchell. Margaret, would you tell us who some of the authors and some of the books are in our last 50 seconds that you would recommend for people who are curious about recent research on Jesus, the historical Jesus?
Well, I still think that one of the most lucid treatments is E.P. Sanders's book, The Historical Figure of Jesus. Also, for Catholic questioners, because we've been talking in a Catholic context in some of the questions, John Meyer, a Catholic priest's multi-volume work, A Marginal Jew.
And his last name is spelled M-E-I-E-R.
Correct.
John Meyer.
Correct.
Mm-hmm.
And he also deals with the relationship between history and theology on some of these issues, particularly about the birth of Jesus and Catholic doctrine. So that may be of interest to some questioners.
Thank you very much. We've been talking with Margaret Mitchell on Keeping the Faith today, a professor at the University of Chicago in New Testament and Early Christian Literature, and we want to thank her very much, as well as our callers today who asked such good questions. My name is Steve Shoemaker. I'm the executive director of the University YMCA, one of the sponsors of this program. Thank you for listening to Keeping the Faith.
You've been listening to a rebroadcast of a Keep in the Faith program, which originally aired in June of this year.
You've been listening to Keep in the Faith, the production of WILL AM 580. The opinions expressed on this program are solely those of the participants.
Today's broadcast is made possible with support from these business partners: Human Kinetics Publishers Incorporated, Champaign; Devro TPAC, Danville; and Illinois Graphics Incorporated, Bloomington. These business partners join the friends of WILL in making great programs possible. Thank you.
Belly Up to the Bar, as to the best of our knowledge, spends an hour with drinkers and drunks. Meet the man who invented the Cosmopolitan. He says it's a really simple drink. All you need is fresh lime juice. That's to the best of our knowledge tonight at 7 Central Time here on AM 580. Tomorrow at 3, AM 580 presents Gray Matters, The Brain Attack, Stroke and the Brain. Leading physicians who work with stroke survivors have adopted the term brain attack to make a point. A stroke is a medical emergency that needs to be viewed and treated with the same urgency as a heart attack. Find out why researchers feel they're on the threshold of having the first true intervention agents for acute stroke treatment. That's Gray Matters, The Brain Attack, Stroke and the Brain, tomorrow at 3 Central Time here on AM 580 WILL Urbana. Tonight in Champaign-Urbana, a chance of rain with the low in the upper 30s and southwest winds 10 to 15 miles per hour. Tomorrow, mostly cloudy with a chance of light rain, mainly in the morning, the high in the lower 40s with west winds 5 to 10 miles per hour. Tomorrow night, partly cloudy with the low in the mid-20s and west winds 10 to 15 miles per hour. You're listening to WILL Urbana, the broadcasting service of the University of Illinois. 580 on your AM dial and on the internet at WILL.UIUC.edu. It's 6 p.m. Central Time. This American Life is next.